On this edition of the Scott Radley Show podcast, we are going to be chatting about some new polling numbers that are out. Now, we don't have an election coming up anytime soon, federally, as far as we know. But there is new polling numbers out about how people are perceiving the federal parties, which is very interesting considering what's been going on in Ottawa. We're going to talk about that. We're going to talk about the Olympics, but not the sports part. For the entirety of the Olympics, China has said no politics allowed, no politics allowed. And then at a press conference, China brought in the politics. We'll talk about that. And we will chat about what's happening in Ukraine because it is it's getting a little scary. All coming up. Stay with us.
Today on the Scott Radley Show on 900 CHML.
There are some new numbers out from Nanos Research. We've had an election, a federal election. I don't think we have one coming up anytime really soon, even though during the last election, the prime minister said if he won a minority, we may be back to the polls soon. I don't think we're there. Yet, you know what? It's instructive sometimes to look at where the people are leaning as far as politically, because it speaks to what's going on in the world. Well, Nanos polling, as I say, has looked into this. Nick Nanos is with us. Nick, thank you so much for the time today. Really appreciate it.
Great to join you and all your listeners.
So there's a few things I really want to dive into here, but let's start with the headline that you identified. I think you were the one who identified this, but certainly it has been pulled out. And that is, there is what's described as a material increase in People's Party support. We know what's going on in Ottawa. We know what's going on around the country. Why are people moving to the People's Party?
Well, you know, I think for many Canadians, they're disappointed and frustrated with all of the mainline parties. And there's a significantly increased number of people that are looking at alternatives. To put this into context, you know, the People's Party was, I think, in the last election got about 5% support. Right now, they're up to 7%. But there's another number that's really an important number. That is the proportion of Canadians that would consider voting for the People's Party of Canada. And over the last number of years, that has hovered at around 10%, or one out of every 10 Canadians. In the latest polling that we've just released in the last day or so, the proportion of Canadians that would consider voting for the People's Party of Canada has gone up from about 10% to 16%, which means that there are just more people thinking about potentially voting for the People's Party of Canada as an alternative to the mainline parties.
So which party or parties should see that as a shot across the bow and a warning?
Well, actually, I'd say all of them, because, you know, the thing is that if you're a conservative, especially, you're looking at a number like this and thinking, you know, the People's Party supporters are likely more conservative minded. Like, let's face it, Maxime Bernier is a former Harper conservative cabinet minister who's leading that party. And for the conservatives, they're probably looking at people who vote for the People's Party as people that, from a conservative perspective, should be voting for the blue team. I guess, why don't we call it original Coke, kind of original conservative, not new conservative.
Yeah.
But you know what? This should still be of concern to the Liberals and even the New Democrats and the Bloc, because my sense is that the People's Party is kind of morphing into more of a movement and more of a coalition of the frustrated and the angry and the disappointed. And I think that's why all of the parties should take note of an increasing number of Canadians that are open to vote for the People's Party.
Do you think this is going to, or should this, I guess, factor in when the Conservatives choose a new leader? Do you pay attention to something like this in who you pick and find someone who is maybe more conservative than Aaron O'Toole was? Is that a message you would take out of this?
Well, I think that's one message for sure. And, you know, it depends if you're a conservative strategist, what you think the path to victory is. If you're a conservative strategist that believes that the path to victory is to consolidate the base in the right wing, and try to pick up pockets of voters to win an election, then you're looking at the People's Party and thinking, you know what, there's a segment of voters that are on the table if you can just appeal to them. However, if you're a conservative strategist that wants to think about forming perhaps a majority government or not going to the right, you're thinking of moving to the center, because the fact of the matter is that even the Liberals in their current configuration under Justin Trudeau are much more progressive and left-wing than previous Liberal prime ministers such as Paul Martin and Jean Chrétien. So the other strategy for the Conservatives is to move not to the center, but towards the center, to take up some of that space that the liberals have abandoned because they've focused so much on progressive politics.
Yeah. And, you know, I can't help but think, certainly, you know, with what's been happening in Ottawa with the truckers and everything else, to see the furthest right party garner votes, it seems as though it's almost a harder rejection of the liberals. And maybe that's unfair or not, but I just look at this and I think, you know, some of the things that the prime minister said probably have infuriated some people enough to push them further and further, skip the middle party, as you say, the old conservatives, yep, and skip and push them right over to the other side because they're infuriated with him.
Absolutely. You know, the thing is that the truckers protest, you know, they're pretty transparent. They want an end to the restrictions and they want the liberals out of power. Like, it's as simple as that. I don't think they wanted Aaron O'Toole. I don't think they went to Ottawa thinking we got to get rid of Aaron O'Toole. That just happened to occur as a result of the protest. But the thing is that what's clear is that Canadians are much more polarized than they have been in the past, and they're fired up. And let's face it, Canadians are in an ugly mood right now. That's all they're doing is thinking about what politician can I punish, because whether you support or oppose, or regardless of how you feel about vaccinations, you're fatigued with the pandemic. You want to know when kids can go to school, when you might be able to go to work, when you could potentially even go on vacation or visit your mom and dad. And until those things are settled, politics is going to be very ugly.
I never know how much credit, I don't know if that's the right word, to give the prime minister as a savvy politician, but let's throw that idea out here for a second. Could this be these comments by the prime minister, is this a winning strategy? You push people way past the conservatives, and when they eventually come back, which they probably will because they want to vote him out, you can then say, look, the conservatives are populated by a bunch of racist, extremist hillbillies who spent all this time with the People's Party.
Yeah, but the problem is with that strategy is that those folks aren't going to vote Liberal. They're probably going to vote for the Bloc Québécois in Quebec. They could vote for the People's Party. Some of those angry voters might even vote for the NDP. But I think the reality is that most Canadians have an opinion about Justin Trudeau. Not very many Canadians are unsure. They have an opinion whether they like him or dislike him.
Yeah.
And there's really nothing happened in the last while for more Canadians to have a greater level of support for Justin Trudeau, which is why when we look at the Liberal numbers, they're still at 31% in the ballot numbers, and the Conservatives are at about 31% too.
The other thing, and let's move on for a second, because the other thing that just jumped off the page when I saw this polling that you just did, we're talking with Nick Nanos from Nanos Research, is Green Party up 0.1, just a tiny bit, but up. PPC up 1.8%, up, not a lot, but up. Bloc Québécois up a point, not a lot, or a percentage, not a lot, but up. Liberal Party up 2.4%. Conservatives up 2.6%. NDP down 7.4%. Every other party has seen an increase here in this polling. The NDP has cratered. What have they done wrong, or have they just been seen as mushy, or like, why this?
Well, you know, the changes that you talked about are changes that have occurred in the last 4 weeks. And 4 weeks ago, before the protest, I think there was a certain proportion of disaffected liberals that were parking with the New Democrats. They might not have been NDP voters or hardcore NDP, but they were just upset with the liberals and Justin Trudeau. But I think what we've learned, and this is why I talked about polarization, what we've learned is that people have moved to the conservatives and the liberals and the PPC and to parties that kind of speak to a greater level of polarization. And I think the fact of the matter is when we think about who are the players in this drama that we're seeing in Ottawa, Windsor, and across the country, the key players are the conservatives, the liberals, and I would hazard to say the People's Party. And don't underestimate Maxime Bernier, because I think I was reading the news and they said that he's got his own little convoy coming from Quebec to Ottawa. He wants to go to Ottawa this weekend. We'll see whether the cops let him in, because it looks like they're building a little perimeter in Ottawa to stop anyone from joining the protest.
So we got to run, but do you then see these figures with your estimation, your expertise? Do you look at this and go, I could see this, these numbers that we just talked about, even growing a little bit? Could the NDP be hurt more? Could the Liberals and Conservatives and PPC go up even more because of what's going on?
Actually, I think the numbers to watch are the PPC numbers.
Still.
Because, yeah, I think so. Yeah, because the fact of the matter is that that's the one, that's the only party that has come out full on in favor, without a doubt, of the truckers' protest. And its party leader, Maxime Bernier, has come out in favor. And you know, he's going to try to grab a tiger by the tail when he comes up to Ottawa. It'll be interesting to see whether, you know, he can broaden his support. Because let's face it, if the People's Party starts to hit 8, 9, 10%, they're going to be a big factor in impacting how many seats all of the federal parties win in the next election.
Nick Nanos from Nanos Research. Always appreciate the time. Thank you for this.
Thank you. Bye-bye.
You're listening to the Scott Radley Show podcast on 900 CHML.
For months and months and months, we have heard Chinese authorities say the Olympics are not about politics. Don't make the Olympics about politics. Don't offer political views at the Olympics. Don't make political statements. Don't make political gestures. This is a sporting event. This is a celebration. This is not a political stage. And you know what? Best I can tell, during the Olympics anyway, nobody has. I don't recall any strong political protests. One shirt I think someone wore saying no war or something. It was a Ukrainian. But yesterday at a press conference, it was a Chinese official at the podium who brought up politics, talking about Taiwan and the Uyghurs and other things. I want to bring in Charles Burton. He is a senior fellow with the Center for Advancing Canada's Interests Abroad at the McDonnell Laurier Institute. He is an expert in all things to do with China. He joins us now. Dr. Burton, thank you as always for the time today.
Speak with you, Scott.
So I think most of the people who have been there and most of the countries have been respectful of not bringing up politics into these games. Now that the Chinese regime, or at least a member of the Chinese regime, has brought up politics, should that be the green light for other countries now to have their moment and say what they feel?
Well, you know, we had thought that some of the athletes might attempt to make some political gestures. You know, there was suggestion by the Uyghurs that when they were on the podium, they should make a sort of a C sign for the crest of the Islamic symbol to indicate their solidarity with the Uyghurs, or other subtle measures. Or we thought that maybe some of the athletes might boycott the opening ceremony as a gesture of showing that they don't approve of, you know, being drawn into a celebratory activity designed to improve China's prestige domestically and internationally. None of that has happened. As you say, I don't think there's been anybody who has dared to make any kind of political gesture during these Olympics, either in expressing concern about the Uyghur genocide, or on the Hong Kong issue, or Taiwan issue, or, you know, all the different human rights violations that you see, not to speak of suppression of religious belief, you know, the tearing down of churches, the recent crackdown on gay and lesbians. So, you know, there's a lot that athletes would be concerned about, not to speak of the Chinese Olympian Peng Shuai, who was disappeared after she posted something that was up briefly on the internet, suggesting that she'd been sexually assaulted by a former member of the Standing Committee of the Politburo. So you have all these things, and so, you know, everybody's been cowed into silence. It takes on a certain element of tacit consent, where you don't say anything in the face of what's going on. And then in the last press conference, the Chinese government repeats all of their usual propaganda lies about, you know, nothing's wrong in Xinjiang and Taiwan, the people of Taiwan should become part of a province of China instead of continuing with their independent democratic politics, and all the other things, you know. So China has politicized at the last minute. I don't think anyone's going to dare say anything for fear of retaliation by the Chinese regime. You know, we had the hostage diplomacy of Kovrigan's favor, and you really, you know, there seems to be, there's almost nothing that's unthinkable in terms of this regime. So I think that, you know, what we were worried about, which is the Chinese would use this as an opportunity to try and claim that Western concerns over China's domestic and international behavior are gross violations of the norms of diplomatic behavior and even crimes against humanity. And that seems to have worked. And, you know, they're ending up having the last word on us.
Am I being harsh by suggesting that it seems that, you know, while China and while the regime in China has said no politics, the Olympics have been nothing but a political platform for China trying to, through sports, through whatever else, make its case to the world? There's been nothing but politics coming from the regime.
Yeah, and you know, and the International Olympic Committee has been complicit in this. You know, the claims that they met with Peng Shuai, the tennis player, but they wouldn't show us any video or say what she had said, you know, but don't worry, everything is fine with her, that kind of stuff. You know, it's troubling, and I really think that it's just not a good way to engage in a celebratory international sports meet to be holding it in countries that have highly questionable international records. You know, that it seems the only countries that are prepared to host these very expensive Olympics in this contemporary era are countries that want to use them for a propaganda purpose. And it really besmirches the ideals of the International Olympic movement and sport when we seem to keep doing this over and over again. I think it's really time for a rethink of whether we should have the Olympics all in one country at a time or whether it should be an event that, you know, is spread out across several countries that have the existing athletic facilities. Because, you know, the Western countries that might have hosted the Olympics all didn't because of the expense of it. You know, the taxpayers
it just costs a lot.
hit with the bill when they've got other things to spend taxpayers' money on.
That said, do you think that in the end, and the Olympics end on Sunday, so we're getting very close to the end here, do you think that China has gained anything on the world stage through this, or have they lost anything through this, or is it a neutral when it all washes out?
Well, I think that it has, you know, caused people like you and me to talk about the situation in China, whereas we wouldn't have done so otherwise. And then there was all the other negative publicity, you know, such as the Canadian Olympic Committee insisting that none of the athletes take their regular electronic devices with them for fear that they would be full of spyware when they came back to Canada. And so they issued the Olympians with one-time use devices for use in China. And the, you know, the suppression of free information and stopping the press from interviewing athletes from Hong Kong and so on and so on. I mean, every story about the Olympics, except for the except for the sports accomplishments, has reflected negatively on China. I don't think there's been a single report that has really focused on, you know, what China wanted us to focus on, which is China's great economic success and beautiful stadiums and efficiency in running the games. That story seems to have been lost. So I think they probably regret hosting it now.
What happens after? So after Sunday, right now, all the eyes of the world are on, and yet the regime probably, I'm guessing, feels pretty good. They've been able to control the narrative. Now that the world goes home and not everyone is watching, what happens there in the wake of this?
Well, I think that's a big concern, is that now China has successfully had these Olympics. And I think from the Chinese government's point of view, the most significant thing is that there hasn't been a humiliation that would have, reflected domestically in China and caused people in China to feel ashamed of their government. Now we have to worry about what their next plan is, and already China's showing considerable support for the Russian stance on Ukraine. And then I think we have to worry about whether China, if Russia is successful in gaining control of Ukraine, would then be emboldened to try something on Taiwan. So, you know, the Olympics ending, you know, is a worry, because they no longer have the constraint of hosting an international sports meet that countries might have withdrawn from if China had done anything further to violate the international rules-based order.
Dr. Charles Burton, we always love when you can give us some time. Thank you for doing this tonight.
Great to speak with you.
You're listening to the Scott Radley Show podcast on 900 CHML.
We are hearing so much information that it's really hard to know what is true right now and what is going on the Ukrainian border, the Russian-Ukrainian border. We're hearing about troop buildups. We're hearing about war. We're hearing about not war. We're hearing about shelling. Here to try and help us sort through what we need to understand about this, Dr. David Marples. He is a professor at the University of Alberta, president of the North American Institute, North American Association for Belarusian Studies. Dr. Marples, thank you so much for the time today.
Yeah, you're very welcome.
So there is a lot of confusion right now, to the point where even the experts who have satellite images and spying and all, even they don't know seemingly what's going on. What's our best understanding of what's happening right now over there?
Well, I think there are two things to keep in mind. First of all, in 2014, after Russia annexed Crimea from Ukraine, they engineered a war in the eastern region of Ukraine, the Donbass. And that war is still continuing today. There have been about 14,000 deaths from the war. About 2 million people have left the region as refugees. And those regions are still under the control of pro-Russian separatist regimes. So the Russians that are amassing on that border, the eastern border, are on the border of two pro-Russian breakaway regimes of Ukraine. So in other words, if they did invade, they would initially enter friendly territories, territories that they already pretty well have control over. The second thing is there's a military exercise in the north between Russia and Belarus. This is a kind of impromptu military exercise. It's not part of the regular pattern of exercises that's been continuing for the last 5 years. This is something that's been arranged very quickly. It's supposed to last from February the 10th to February the 20th. But the fact is that some of those designated areas for Russian and Belarusian troops to carry out their military exercise have been expanded, or at least there are Russian troops now on the northern part of Ukraine, just north of Kiev region, close to the border with Belarus. And there's something like 30,000 Russian troops in that region with very advanced weaponry. So on both sides, Ukraine is facing this. There's also a military exercise that's supposed to finish in a couple of days in Crimea to the south. So in effect, these troops are now on three sides of Ukraine. And according to the Russians, none of them are there for invasion purposes. But never before has so much equipment been brought up, and never before have they been there quite so long in the case of the troops in the east, who have been there, mobilized there since November. So this is really kind of the background to where we are today.
And when they talk about exercises, let's hope. I mean, for certain, let's hope that this is just an exercise, but it doesn't seem like many, many, many people around the world are buying that argument that this is just an exercise. I mean, just a couple of days ago, I read a report that Russian machinery, Russian apparatus had been moved into attack position. Maybe that's an exercise. That sounds a little more, I don't know, aggressive than an exercise.
It's very aggressive. I mean, the whole rhetoric coming from Russia has been aggressive from the very beginning. You know, making demands of NATO, demanding that Ukraine should never join, and at the same time backing this up with the military. But also, I didn't mention earlier, but the Russian Navy occupies the Azov Sea to the east of Ukraine and the Black Sea to the south of Ukraine. So the entire naval aspect of this is another thing to be considered, because Ukrainian ships can't get out of their own harbors. So it is aggressive. And I think, you know, the real goal is not so much on an international scale, you know, to force NATO to come to the table and make concessions. I think Russia recognizes that's never going to happen. The key thing is to destabilize the Ukrainian government and eventually ensure that Ukraine has a pro-Russian government in place like it did before 2014, and that it's not likely to join NATO or European structures in the future. Mm. I think it's the wrong way to go about it, quite frankly, well, but it seems to be what they're wanting.
Now, I don't know if you have any military analyst background in you, but we keep hearing this phrase, and some people may be familiar with it, others won't, We keep hearing the expectations that Russia will stage a false flag attack in order to lead to a sort of an opening or an acknowledgement that, hey, we're allowed to attack now. Because what is a what would a false flag attack be, and why would that, in some eyes, give Russia the go-ahead?
It would probably come from the Ukrainian side of the Donbass, that is where the government part of those two regions, which is actually the largest part of the Donbass, but not the two major cities, if those troops advanced. And this could happen because that the borderline seems to go back and forth within a mile or two quite regularly, and it has done for the past few years. Or you could see in that same region, Russian troops, maybe even disguised, simulating an attack on that region from the west. The attack would have to come from the west in order for it to look like it's coming from Ukraine. In fact, it's very unlikely to happen, you know, given the sizes of the two military forces. There's no conceivable way that a Ukrainian army would attack Russia. It may try to regain these two regions in some kind of conception, but it's not done so yet because it's always abided by the Minsk Accords of 2015 and not tried to annex the regions outright and bring them back into the Ukrainian state as they were for the previous 25 years or so.
But that would be the idea, though. We're gonna make it look like Ukraine has attacked us. Therefore, we're not the aggressor anymore. We have to defend ourselves and go and stop at the false flag.
That's right. But I mean, the United States has exposed every single time that seems to be about to happen. The United States has sort of exposed it. And Secretary Blinken for one, but also President Biden for another. At each stage of the way, they have made it very clear what Russia is doing. And so I don't think there's much chance of a false flag operation convincing anyone of it, of, that it's genuine.
At this point, with somewhere between, we're told, 130 and 150,000 Russian troops on the Ukrainian border or close to it, does the Ukraine have the capacity to really defend itself, or would this be a very quick, very overwhelming force if Russia did, and this would be over very fast?
I think it would be long and it would be messy if they tried to occupy Ukraine with 150,000 troops. I mean, simply not enough. By comparison, you know, back in the late 1960s, when the Soviet Union and its allies invaded Czechoslovakia, a country much smaller than Ukraine, they used 500,000 troops to do it. So with 150,000, you may have some kind of, let's say, partial plan, to say maybe occupy all of the Donbass or capture the port of Mariupol or something of that nature. You've not got enough troops there to occupy all of Ukraine. It's simply not on. They could bomb Ukraine. They could cause extensive damage and losses of lives, but they couldn't occupy all of Ukraine with the force that's there now.
But the world, and this is where this gets so difficult. I mean, we've got wars that countries are trying to get out of. We've got fatigue with wars in a lot of places. It doesn't seem likely that the world would come rushing to Ukraine's aid because they don't want to get in another morass like they had in the Middle East. And you've also got China sort of looming over Russia's shoulder. Does anybody come to Ukraine's aid if there was to be a war?
No, I suspect not, because Ukraine is not a member of NATO. If it was a NATO country that was being attacked, then by NATO law, NATO has to come to the aid of that country. And this, of course, is why Ukraine wants to join NATO so badly, because it would give them that added security. But in fact, since they're not a member of NATO, it just isn't going to happen. And I think everyone from Biden downwards has made that quite clear, that these countries would not come to the aid of Ukraine other than by sending, let's say, defensive weapons or giving loans or sending materials, things of that nature, which are defensive and would not constitute an act of war against the Russian Federation. That's all I think that the West would do. And China would probably keep out of it as well.
There was a suggestion that I read today, and boy, it sounded like an awful lot of work and effort to, but you know, I mean, look, these are big things. The suggestion was Russia's not really going to attack, but the fact that Russia has made Western countries, including the States, offer these warnings again and again, when it doesn't attack, if that happens, it will have ruined the credibility of the Western countries that had raised the alarm, and that would be a win unto itself. That seems like a bit of a stretch, doesn't it? That we're doing all, that Russia is doing all of this just to get the states to cry wolf a few times?
Yeah, I don't think that that is the ultimate goal. I think that Russia's tried to exploit the fact that the United States has made several statements that weren't really backed up by evidence. And one of those was the alleged date of attack, which was supposed to be February the 16th, yesterday. And nothing, of course, happened then. And there's sort of sarcastic comments coming out of Russia as well. Mm-hmm. Putin saying, well, should I ask the United States if this is the right day to attack by their calendar? Mm-hmm. But it can only go so far. And I think, you know, Russia's assembled all these troops, raised the rhetoric. Sergei Lavrov's making statements almost every day, the Russian foreign minister. At what point can you legitimately back off and have achieved nothing?
Yes.
That's the question I've raised before in an article I wrote, that you would think that Russia would want something tangible out of all this. And what can you claim is possibly tangible? Bringing the Western powers to the table, perhaps. But ultimately, the consequences could be quite disastrous to the Russian economy if it ends up in severe sanctions, or if Russia's cut off from international banking.
And that's it, right? That's what Biden has said and others have said. If you do this, there will be severe consequences. If it's not going to be military, is that what we're talking about then, that we're going to see major sanctions, and would that have any impact?
It would certainly have some impact. I mean, the current sanctions are for the Russian annexation of Crimea back in 2014, and they're still having an impact on Russia today. Russia is a superpower militarily. I think you could say that. Economically, it certainly isn't. It's not on anything like the same level as Canada. It's more like its economy is about the same size as Italy. So you're looking at a medium power at best, dealing with some powers like the United States and China, which could really can claim to be world economic powers. So in other words, Putin is batting out of his league, in a baseball phrase.
Yes,
but
yes.
At the same time, he does have the military hardware behind him to make threats. And as Russia is a nuclear weapons power, one has to be very careful how to deal with it.
Yeah, absolutely.
I think the West is, you know, the West has this problem of tread gently, because, you know, if Russia does resort to something extremely violent, this could end up being a nuclear confrontation at the same time. And that's never happened before, but we've come close a few times in the Soviet period. This is really the first time in the independence period.
It's kind of terrifying. We only have a minute left here. And so just one thing, and I shouldn't have left this to the end, but you know what? I thought big finish, although then I've left us not enough time. The billion-dollar question here, and you've alluded to it a little bit, but the billion-dollar question is, what does Russia want out of? Why is this happening? What is the end goal here for Russia?
I think it's all about Ukraine. I mean, this has come out a few times. I think Russia, for Putin and others, it's obvious that United States or NATO was never going to respond positively to demands like Ukraine can never be a member. This brought people to the table, but I think the ultimate goal is to destabilize the Ukrainian government, because Putin has never recognized Ukrainian independence. He claims that Ukrainians and Russians are the same people. And he said on more than one occasion that Ukraine is his red line. He will never allow Ukraine to join Western structures, NATO, European Union, whatever. He simply won't allow it. It's a personal thing for Putin, and I think it's all about Ukraine.
Dr. David Marples from the University of Alberta, so much appreciate your time to explain this today. Thank you so much.
Yep, my pleasure.
The Scott Radley Show, weekday evenings from 6 to 8 on 900 CHML.
The Scott Radley Show podcast is available on Apple Podcasts, Google Podcasts, and wherever you get your podcasts. I'm Scott Radley. Thanks again for listening, and do not forget to subscribe to this podcast. It is free. You will never miss an episode. And also, be sure you rate us and review us. Whatever you think of us, we'll take it. Thanks for listening.
I'm not just a pawn in this game.
Three nights a week on Global.
They're putting targets on their back. Massive.
Drama.
I guess you could say I'm in a showman.
They're just so in love and so annoying. Enough.
Betrayal.
The guy just put up his best friend now.
And plot twists.
What is happening right now?
You'll never see coming.
If you're coming for me,
this is perfect.
I'm coming for you then.
It'll be a battle.
Like, it'll be war.
Big Brother Canada. All new Tuesdays, Wednesdays, and Sundays on Global. Stream on Stack TV.